Before you and I embark on a road trip, we almost always begin by planning the itinerary. As we do so, we tend to weigh two options. There is the standard route. It's the tried and true way. It's the way that all of our families and friends know about and use. And then there's the shortcut. Now, the shortcut tends to maximize speed, but it also comes with greater risks. Depending on our circumstances, we will choose one of those two paths, the standard route or the shortcut. But none of us, at least not intentionally, begin with the hope of discovering a longer path. None of us knowingly elect to take the roundabout way unless other factors outweigh the goal of simply arriving at our destination in a timely fashion. In today's text, God takes the Hebrews on the roundabout way. He takes them on an expedition through the wilderness as opposed to the well-traveled road that ran directly from Egypt to Canaan. In this instance, the standard path and the shortcut were one and the same. There was only one good option, but God did not select it. Instead, the Lord created a new path because he knew the Hebrews could not handle the dangers and the risks that were present in the shortcut. You know this text here in Exodus chapter 13, beginning with verse 17 down through verse 22. It's an important passage because it begins the second main section in the book of Exodus. The first 12 and a half chapters focus on Israel and Egypt, but beginning here in chapter 13 and verse 17, we begin to focus on Israel in the wilderness. The historical scholars have routinely showed great interest in these passages. Scholars have been able to confirm that there was a well-fortified military road on the direct route that ran from the Egyptian Delta into Canaan. Had the Hebrew people taken the shortcut, they would likely have arrived in the Promised Land somewhere between 10 and 12 days. They also likely would have encountered other people groups along that path. Conversely, we know very little about the path that the Hebrews actually followed. While there is general consensus that the Hebrew people moved southeast after leaving Egyptian territory, archaeologists have never been able to locate with any certainty the places mentioned in chapters 13 and 14 of Exodus. Succoth, Etham, Migdal, the sea that the Israelites crossed, or even Mount Sinai. In short, we cannot accurately and positively recreate the path that the Hebrews traveled precisely because it was not an established route that anyone took when traveling from Egypt to Canaan. Yet, while our geography remains fuzzy, we have much more clarity when we read Exodus 13 from a narrative or a theological perspective. You know the story well. The Hebrews are freed from slavery by the mighty acts of God. They begin a slow transition from being Pharaoh's slaves into being God's followers. They head for the Promised Land. They could have taken the interstate. If so, all the Israelites needed to do was to prepare themselves to fight if they encountered foes. The Israelites are already traveling in groups of 50, which they later use as their military formation. So some translators even say they're prepared for battle as they're traveling. Or the Israelites could have taken the interstate and simply trusted that God would perform a miracle if they needed it. My goodness, the whole book of Exodus is filled with miracles. One more could not have been that difficult. God could have protected them, no matter the dangers that they would have encountered. But the Israelites avoided the direct route. Instead of 2 weeks, the journey would now take at least 6 months, and of course, you and I know that 6 months turns into 40-plus years. In the end, the Israelites followed an itinerary that MapQuest could not even reproduce. The author needed to explain this course of events. It looks haphazard at best. And the logic that the author provides has nothing to do with speed or distance. Instead, the author merely says it was the Lord who chose this path. And the Lord chose this path because of his compassion. The Lord demonstrated his love for and his patience with the Hebrews by taking them the roundabout way through the wilderness. The Lord knew the Hebrews better than they knew themselves. The Lord functioned like a shepherd who knew what was best for his sheep, even if they had no clue where the shepherd was leading them. In fact, had the Israelites actually arrived in Canaan after 10 or 12 days via the highway, they would have been totally unprepared for life in Canaan. The author wants us to know that the Lord was leading the Israelites throughout these confusing days. Theologically, the text is also clear. The author doesn't simply stress that God is guiding, but the author stresses that God was present. As I mentioned, archaeologists can't reproduce where the cities actually were. They cannot reproduce where the Hebrews actually walked. That information has simply been lost to us. Perhaps this demonstrates for us that what was most important was not first and foremost about geography or physical location. Instead, the insights that have been preserved for us are first and foremost theological ones. In Exodus 13 and 14, we know that God was with the Israelites on their unpredictable journey. The Lord actually journeyed with the Hebrew people. Just as the fire and smoke imagery at the burning bush in Exodus 3 symbolized God's presence, just as the fire and smoke imagery at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19 symbolized God's presence, so also here in Exodus 13, the pillar of cloud by day, the fire by night, they teach us that God was perpetually present with his people. He never left them. Even on a road that seemingly led to nowhere, even on the roundabout way through the wilderness, the Lord was with them. The Lord journeyed alongside of them. At times the Lord was in the front, and at times the Lord was in the back, but the Lord was always with them. Throughout this year, our sermon series is organized around the idea of the preacher selecting a text that has shaped them in their spiritual lives. In my own life, God has used this text on numerous occasions to help me interpret my own experiences. When I was 17, I recall traveling along a road that felt like uncharted wilderness. From infancy, I was raised in a small Texas town, Van Alstine, Texas. It's a farming community. And around my first birthday, my parents divorced. I guess the blessing of your parents divorcing when you're a year old is that you don't experience any of that initial turmoil. For me, the real challenge of having parents that divorced when I was a year old was facing the question of whether my father would ever play any role in my life other than that of a stranger who periodically took me away from home against my will. From those earliest days, my father faithfully picked my older brother and me up, but those monthly visitations were often traumatic. I think what was almost as difficult as the divorce portion of that experience, it was when my mother remarried. My mother had raised my brother and I as a single parent for 13 years. She remarried, and to this day I'm very grateful for my stepfather, but it immediately shifted me from being a resident in my home to being a guest. But the crisis for me really arose 3 years later. It's when my mother and stepfather decided that they would move into the DFW Metroplex. So here I am, small Texas town boy, and my mother was moving to big city. It was near the end of my junior year of high school, and the transition simply could not have come at a worse time for me. Not only had my family dynamics changed, but now I was facing departure from the only town, the only friends, and the only church I'd ever known. After much prayer and deliberation, I concluded that God wanted me to stay put in Van Alstine, even though my mother would be moving on. So I talked to a couple, John and Mary Wade. John was a bivocational pastor and also one of my high school teachers. I approached John and Mary, and I asked them if I could live with them for a year before I went off to college. And they graciously welcomed me into their home and into their family. Everything seemed to fall in place. It appeared to me that God had set up the entire arrangement just for me. But 3 months later, despite the incredible hospitality that the Wades had offered to me, I was inexplicably restless and perhaps even tormented in my soul. I had done what I thought God had wanted, and yet I did not sense that I was anywhere near the center of God's will. I felt internally conflicted, and I had a sense of spiritual unrest. The entire experience was very disturbing to me. Most importantly, I wondered whether I had ever heard God speak at all. Had I made the whole thing up? Had I taken a label of God's will and just stamped it on my own desires? However, I read this passage of Scripture one morning, and somehow God intervened and provided me with a sense of clarity and comfort. It was that day when I read this Scripture that I decided I would move to the Texas coast and live with my father for the first time in my life. It was the one option I had not considered until that day. In the end, I moved, and I absolutely experienced God's presence in the process, as well as a tremendous sense of blessing. The year was good for me. It certainly helped me prepare for college. It was during that year I was able to meet my future wife. My father and I bonded in a way that we had not up to that point. It afforded me opportunities to preach in that county that I might not have had otherwise. And most importantly, it forced me to lean upon God in a way that I had never done. When I reflect back on those experiences, as the years go by, and I'm getting much older now, the geography of my journey gets more and more fuzzy to me. Truth is, I cannot accurately retrace the steps with any confidence. It's almost as if the geographical exactness has been lost. These days, I'm not truthfully able to discern what God asked of me and what I decided to do on my own. I'm not sure really what was God's initiative and what were my own hang-ups. Yet what continues to become more and more clear to me is that God had compassion upon me. At a tumultuous time in my life, God gave me a gift. I was having a difficult time facing the challenges of my life. I might have turned back, but God journeyed with me. He either guided me or perhaps permitted me to take the slower path, the roundabout way. Whether it was my doing or his, God used the roundabout way of the wilderness to shape me more closely into one of his followers. Never before had I needed to depend upon him so exclusively, yet day and night he traveled a very unclear path with me. When I read the Scriptures, I'm comforted to see that God used the roundabout path for a variety of his followers. The Lord certainly guided Abraham and Hosea on circuitous paths. Saul encountered Jesus while traveling on a roundabout road to Damascus. Peter was only able to embrace the Gentile mission after a confusing trip to Joppa. And most importantly, the glory of the resurrection was only seen after the roundabout path of the crucifixion. I'm betting that at some point God has traveled a roundabout way with many of you as well. Perhaps in your faith journey, perhaps in your call to ministry, maybe even here in your life in Waco. But thankfully, God continued to use this text in my life long after my 18th birthday. Most recently, God has used this text to shape my thoughts about Christian ministry. I can't help but make a connection between the theological depiction of God in Exodus 13 and the ministries that we have as servants of God. In particular, if the Lord resembles a patient shepherd in Exodus 13, then surely the image of patient shepherd ought to characterize our ministries as well. Today, ministers are facing a growing challenge. In recent years, we have routinely embraced the idea of being visionary leaders for our congregations. Just as God led the Israelites, so we want to lead our congregations. But at times, we have neglected the ministry of presence that is also manifest in Exodus 13. Increasingly, we want to lead, but we're not as interested in journeying with our congregations. Currently, the business world often supplies us with our images for pastoral ministry. Businesses chart direct paths to reaching their goals. Yet businesses seldom care whether some people are lost along the way. Businesses understand guidance and leadership, but not ministerial presence. In ministry, we need both. God-given direction can be a true blessing, and ministerial leadership is clearly needed. Yet as Christian ministers, we cannot afford to take the direct routes if it means that many of our people will turn back to Egypt. At times, Christian ministry requires us to select the roundabout way. In truth, the guidance we provide and the destinations we select will often be far less important than the act of journeying with our congregants, regardless of where we actually travel. In years gone by, I've taken a variety of church ski trips with young people, both college groups and youth groups. And the same pattern inevitably appears when you take a group of young people to the top of a ski slope. You have a few skilled daredevils in the group, and you're lucky if you can point a direction down the hill before they take off racing down the mountain. But you also have some uncoordinated beginners who should have taken lessons. Of course, they swore to you beforehand they did not need lessons, but they lied. You're lucky if you can get down the mountain in less than 2 hours, and they will only make it down the mountain, at least on skis, if someone is there to coach them the entire way. It certainly helps to have someone leading from the front, zigzagging a path for the beginners down the mountain. But even more important, you must have someone who's willing to lead from behind. You must have someone who is uphill from the beginning skiers, someone who is willing to pick them up with compassion when they fall, who will help them put their skis back on when the skis have fallen off, someone who will encourage them down the mountain. Sometimes, serving as a minister of our patient Lord demands that we employ patience. It demands that we knowingly avoid the shortcuts. It demands that we willingly take the roundabout way with our congregants. We must do ministry both at the front and the back of the crowd. We must walk with people, both individuals and congregations, on the long road to God's will for their lives. Having the patience to wait on congregations who have all different types of travelers is almost a lost art in ministry. I know of a deceased Baptist pastor who, for 40 years of ministry, resolved to take 3 full years to implement any new idea. He would take 3 years to hint, suggest, eventually discuss a new idea before he ever asked the congregation to vote. Of course, to employ such a strategy meant that he had to bridle the excitement and the adrenaline that comes with newness. It meant that he actually had to think through and pray through his ideas. It meant that his compassion for his congregation outweighed his lust for change. But it also meant that he took the ministry of presence as seriously as he took the ministry of guidance. Ministerial leadership that mimics both God's guidance and God's presence, as manifest here in Exodus 13, will not be obsessed with direct paths, but it may well employ roundabout routes as extensions of God's compassion. Most of us will experience chaotic and confusing times in our lives. Perhaps it's in our individual journeys of faith or in our calls to ministry. Perhaps it's in the life of our congregations, or perhaps in our service to God. Seldom will we experience direct paths. Regardless, take courage. Do not underestimate what our compassionate God can do in and through and among us as we travel a roundabout way through the wilderness.